Welcome to this episode of RF Industry Icons Podcast. I'm Pat Hindle, and I'm here with Gary LaRude. Today, we are talking with Erwin Jacobs, founder of Qualcomm Technologies. Erwin taught electrical engineering and computer science at MIT and University of California, San Diego, before co-founding Linkabit Corporation. Then after briefly retiring, and I mean brief, he went on to found Qualcomm with a small group of engineers and developed the underlying technology that would be used for 3G cellular networks. He has been recognized for his pioneering telecommunication work many, many times, with awards including the National Medal of Technology and the IEEE Medal of Honor, the organization's highest award. Welcome to the podcast, Erwin.
Glad to be with you today.
So I read that when you went to Cornell, you were in the hotel school, but when your roommate made fun of how easy your courses were, you transferred to electrical engineering. I was at Cornell too in engineering. I had almost the opposite happen. It was very challenging and found the work quite overwhelming at some times. So I was thinking about transferring to the hotel school because I was told, oh, that's so easy. So when did you realize that you wanted to be an engineer and work in the wireless industry? Was it from that or were there other things that happened?
Well, when I was going to high school, I was certainly interested in science, engineering, physics, math, the works. And unfortunately, it was 1950. I graduated, and my high school counselor said there was no future in science nor engineering, which was a little bit of a mistake. However, nobody in the family really knew about that, how the prospects might be. And when he asked what the family did, my folks had bought a restaurant about a year earlier. And so I mentioned that. He said, oh, you have to go to Cornell to the hotel school. And so I did apply and was accepted and spent a year and a half in the hotel school. And by the way, I did get some useful information. I took a course in accounting a whole year, which turned out to be very good, and a term in business law. So without knowing it at the time, it was very helpful. However, I knew hotel life, as I learned more about it, was really not for me. I did have a roommate who was an engineer who kept kidding me that you couldn't possibly get those grades if you were in engineering. And I was beginning to feel I really needed to look into a change. And so I was home over my Christmas holiday vacation, stopped in to see a former math teacher at the high school and a former chemistry teacher, talked with them, came away from that deciding I'd go back early to Cornell and try to do a transfer. And in accordance with your earlier comment, it took about 30 minutes to convince the dean of students, I think it was, that I was interested in going from hotel to engineering and not the other way. That confusion persisted for a while, but I did convince him, and he was very helpful. I told him either engineering physics or electrical engineering. He said, I know a professor in electrical, let me connect you with him. That's how I ended up in electrical engineering. As a matter of fact, I think it took a few months before the hotel school found out I was no longer in the hotel school.
Oh my gosh, that's a great story. Well, after attending Cornell and you got your undergraduate degree, you went to MIT for graduate degrees, and then you taught at MIT and UCSD. Why did you decide to become a professor, and what were those years like?
Well, it was interesting, first of all, going on to graduate education. I met my wife at Cornell. We married when she graduated, which was 2 years ahead of me because of the hotel and five-year program at the time in engineering. And so I thought I would go to work, but I was a co-op student, and I had advice from one of the engineers I work with on co-op that perhaps I ought to look into graduate school. So I did apply to MIT, applied for a General Electric National Fellowship. Luckily, they both came through, and off we went to Cambridge. Went through school there in 3 years, and I was lucky enough to receive an invitation to teach at MIT, which was very exciting. I had worked in communication theory, information theory. I arrived at MIT in 1956, and it was the same year that Claude Shannon came to MIT as a faculty member, so there was a lot of that excitement. when I had the opportunity to teach, I also was then with another professor, Jack Wozencraft, given the opportunity of setting up a senior course in communication theory. And we thought we'd bring information theory in and see what we might be able to do with that in a practical sense. And so went ahead and we taught the course for a few years, and from the notes, developed a textbook, which was the first one in digital communications. And it's still available on Amazon, as far as I know, although it's long out of copyright. That was very exciting. However, we've been hearing friends tell us about California and how wonderful it was. So I took a year's leave in 1964-65 academic year, and bought an old van from a real estate company. We had three children at the time, fitted out the van and drove cross country for 3 weeks, spent 9 months in California, 3 months, 3 weeks coming back across Canada. In any case, just after coming back to MIT, had a call from a former Cornell professor, Henry Booker, that he was going out to a brand new university in San Diego. And would I come and help start engineering? Well, family, friends, career, everything's on the East Coast. So he turned it down. But for the next couple of days, really unhappy with the decision, and came home after a heavy rain. My wife greeted me at the door. We'd been looking for a home around Boston to buy. And she said, listen to this, and described a wonderful sounding contemporary home. So I said, great, let's go look at it tomorrow. She said, only one problem. It's in La Jolla. And that was enough to flip us. So we called up UCSD and said, if it's still open, we're coming. And we drove cross country one more time. By then we had a fourth boy. So it was quite an undertaking. I often say that arriving in La Jolla, it took about 10 minutes to adjust. It's such a wonderful place and climate and everything else out here. And so ended up teaching at UCSD, which also was quite interesting. First of all, a public university, a brand new one. So the first graduating class wasn't for a couple of years after I arrived. And thus putting together a curricula, planning the university itself with a college-based system, a whole number of things were rather exciting about it. However, because I had co-authored this textbook, which was the first one again on digital communications, there were all kinds of requests for consulting. And I normally consult back at MIT and now at UCSD a day a week. So I was coming down from a trip to from NASA Ames, and sitting next to a couple of faculty from UCLA, Andy Fraterbi and Len Kleinrock. And I mentioned to them that there was all this consulting. They said, oh, let's start a company and share consulting. So that's how Linkovit started. It was going to be, for me, a day a week consulting. Well, it started, I ended up continuing the consulting. It began to grow as far as ideas. We hired a couple of students who would come out with me to complete their doctorate degrees from MIT, and began to get more and more complicated. So I decided to take a year's leave from UCSD get things organized. Then I had to decide, of course, after years, whether to go back or to remain with the company. Well, it was very exciting trying to develop new products, bring them to market. And my rationalization for leaving academic life at that point was, for years I've been advocating a theory that it was going to be very important in the real world. Well, here was a chance to show that, in fact, that was the case. So that's kind of the reason I finally left academia and ended up business.
So with Linkovit, it started out as kind of a consulting basis, but then it evolved into products. So how did that business plan and company develop?
First of all, we didn't have a business plan when we started. We never really had one until a little later after we got some products. But we thought that government business might be a good way to go. And we... at that time, if you had a good idea, you could submit it to one of the agencies and get a very quick response. and often some progress payments. And so we began to do work for the government. I think one of the first large jobs was with, I think it was still ARPA, but DARPA now. And it was to extend the ARPANET over to Europe. And we've been working on some satellite modems. And so we bid on that, got the job. That's actually how I got hooked on email, was because we were working with several companies around the US and a few in Europe. And email, even on the beginnings of the ARPANET, was still a very handy way to keep in touch with one another. And so we went ahead and developed this SatNet connection over to Europe. And actually, the first, some early traffic was among three different networks using the first version of the internet protocol on three different networks, the ARPANET, the SatNet, and a packet radio network. And we didn't think about it too much at the time, but the Computer History Museum in 2007 called us all together to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the first traffic using the internet algorithm. So that was kind of one of the early projects at Linkabit. We continued on into commercial business. We bid on a program for Schlumberger where they wanted to have a SAT terminal that could go out with the trucks, send back information about the drilling operations, provide that to the customer, and let the customer decide, should we keep drilling or go on to the next site? And so we won that contract. We built that terminal. It went into use quite successfully. And then we thought that, well, maybe a small, much less expensive version of this could be useful commercially. And so we did do what we call VSATs, very small aperture earth terminal, very first VSATs. We had to get permission, of course, from the FCC, which we did. Our first customer, I think first large customer, was Walmart to connect all their stores and warehouses together. We included a video link so that they could use a presentation, I think, every Friday to the troops. And so that turned out well. I think 7-Eleven was a second customer, and then it spread to gas stations, et cetera. So that was a very good product. A very large government program had to do with a satellite terminal. And we won a contest for providing that. I think was initially some early work with the Navy, but then it was an Air Force contract. And we proposed using a terminal that was based on a microprocessor, even though single chip microprocessors didn't exist at the time. So we had to go ahead and put it one together using arithmetic registers, different separate POT, ROM, et cetera. And we did that, but to keep it simple and to keep the memory requirements, we actually had the first restricted information set, the RISC processor. It had 32 instructions and 5 stacks, so we could hop between subroutines. And it was largely actually a major input of Klein Gilhausen, who was another one of our early engineers that we hired. I had originally met him on consulting. He had gone off to school, and we hired him after he finished his degree. He was very prominent a lot of things at Linkabit and then Qualcomm. In any case, we had to go around and convince different research groups in the supporting the Air Force that this was a reasonable way to go ahead. And we did. We got contract to go ahead and develop it. And then it turned out that we were competing with Rockwell, and they were the major supplier, potential supplier to the Air Force for this terminal. While that was happening, we also ended up with a contract that said we would extend the technology to include operating with another pair of terminals, Lincoln West 8, West 9, Lincoln Experimental Satellite 8 and 9, which had a completely different set of capabilities. And so we ended up calling this a dual modem because it would work with two different sets of capabilities. Never quite sure we could do it, but we always were risk takers. And we did proceed. The Lincoln one was interesting in that we did get a call while we're still finishing the software. And could we bring the terminal back to Lincoln Lab to test it, because the West 8 and 9 were about to be shipped down. I think it was still Cape Kennedy at the time. But anyway, shipped down for launch. And they'd like to see if our terminal would work with the satellites. And so I spent with another engineer, Franklin Antonio, a couple of days and nights finishing software. And then I carried on my lap back to Lincoln Lab, hit an ice storm, so we wait getting over to Lincoln Lab. Finally did get there. They wanted to go for lunch. I said, well, that's at least, you had a different forward link and reverse link because of two satellites. Let's at least test the forward link. We set it up. They said, we can turn off the hopping and the other code-related aspects. I said, no, let's go ahead and try. We did, and suddenly the teletype began to type out the forward message. And so I said, okay, let's go for lunch. Finished lunch, we came back and tried the reverse link. Didn't work. And we started looking at our stuff. All the information we'd gotten from Lincoln, almost all of it, was handwritten notes. Well, what they found was that they had misread some of their own handwritten notes on a matrix, corrected that, and then the reverse link worked. And so here we had a forward and reverse link. They called up their supervisor to see this, and he was very impressed with it. I said, you know, I've been telling people for years that you don't need a PhD to take work from Lincoln Lab and make it operate. And I said, well, that may be the case, but you can't prove it by us. So it turned out that Lincoln didn't have their own terminal working. And so the only test was because we were able to bring back our terminal and work. One other story with that, I went to a design review for the Air Force terminal and ran into a Rockwell engineer. There was a crypto algorithm that was given to us by the Air Force as a fairly thick book of hardware diagrams on how to build this encryption device. And of course, that's the way Rockwell built it. I had one day coming back on a flight from Boston, realized that how you might do it in software. And that's how we did it on our little RISC computer. And there was a requirement that this was based on inserting a code, which could take as long as you want to do that, but then putting in time, and every 5 milliseconds, a code word had to come out. And if you lost time and put a new time in to get started again, you had, I think it was 10 seconds to begin to spread out code words. Well, with the hardware, you couldn't make it run fast enough to do that. So Rockwell's hardware could never quite get up there, even what was at the time the fastest Echo logic. And with the software, we could. And so one of their project engineers came up to me at this meeting and said, I've been told that you're using software for the algorithm. And thought about it and said, well, yes, we are. And he said, and there's a rumor that you can meet the 10-second requirement. And I said, maybe it was a 3-second, but whatever, a requirement. And I said, yes, we can. And he looked at me and he said, you're a liar. So that got me ready for a lot of future such comments with senior me. Any case, the last story on that, I told you I have long stories. In order to go into production on this, or compete for the production contract, we need one last classified contract to get all the paperwork, et cetera, in place for production. And so went up to see the head of the missile organization, a general up in Los Angeles. And I started to tell him about the project and said, don't have to. I've been well briefed on it. I've been well briefed on Rockwell. He said, listen, I'm a project engineer. My key thing is to make sure that my projects get done. I can deliver them to the customer. I've had a lot of experience with Rockwell on this, and they've come through. They may miss a few requirements, but close enough. And I thought at that point that was it. He wasn't going to go ahead and give us the contract. And he paused dramatically, and he said, but as a taxpayer, I will give you this contract to prepare for production, which he did. And then we won almost all the production. So that was a big kickoff for Linkabit. And happened about the time that we merged with MACOM. After that, we got this contract with HBO to build a satellite-to-home scrambling device so they could scramble the video from the satellite to the home. Actually, it was originally to go to the cable heads. So it was a professional device that they asked for a bid on. We won the contract, and we were very close to finishing it when, in a sense, had our first encounter with Congress. A group of backyard dish owners who had been receiving HBO on their backyard dishes said they were willing to pay something to HBO, but they couldn't take away their service. So they were going to Congress to get protection. And HBO felt, well, maybe we can't scramble after all. And then John Malone, I think it was, came back and said, look, I've got a clause in my contract that says I get the lowest rate of anybody. If it's free for those users, it's free for me. So they had no choice but continue to try to build a home unit. And so then our problem was, how do you go from a professional unit, which had lots of chips and could be maintained by a technician, to something to put in the home, cheap, reliable. And so to do that, we had to develop some chips. And luckily, we'd been experimenting with software from MIT, from Caltech, and others on designing chips on computers and testing them. And we had set up some homework problems to train our people on this, but we suddenly needed to develop three chips to be able to build this descrambler home unit. And so we set out to do it. And sure enough, those three chips all ended up working the first time. And so we ended up with a great product. I went to Puerto Rico to set up a factory to build it because at that time, any value added in Puerto Rico was free, was tax-free in the U.S. Yeah. And so we found an old factory there at a village. We came to that factory, and the villagers, the people in that little village, had gone, cleaned up this old factory, set it up as if it looked like it was in production, had people there. We were so impressed with that. Obviously, we had to make that choice, which we did. So that was about the time, and we had that all set up, ready to go, that there were some changes at MACOM, and I decided to leave the company. And unfortunately, they then sold that to General Instrument, I think it was, and made a lot of money, bought back a lot of their own stock, gave out a lot of bonuses. They also sold the VSAT business to Hughes, and did the same thing. Unfortunately, eventually went bankrupt, but luckily came back out.
Well, Pat and I both worked at MACOM in the late 90s and the early 2000s, and we recall very vividly that MACOM executives called that the company's biggest mistake, basically carving up Linkabit and selling it off. So from your perspective, what do you think went wrong there? Why did it fall apart?
Before that, there was a very good CEO who was an when I decided to join with it, who was also an MIT PhD in physics, actually. Any case, he had remarried and moved to Florida and tried to run the company from Florida as a result of that. And then he decided there were a couple of people who remained from the old Microwave Associates that really weren't appropriate any longer. And so we went to the board to fire them. I was on the board, but I was over for some reason in Europe at the time. And they decided to fire Larry instead. And that led me to say, okay, I'm going to trail off in this and eventually leave, which I did in 85. And I didn't follow MACOM too carefully. Again, the board, the executives are key. They no longer had Larry. I had left. And the board made, I think, just a series of mistakes. But I think the largest mistakes were selling off a couple of these great products and selling your future.
Yeah, I think sometimes the executives try to realize value and spin off things that actually turn out to be a mistake. So I think they were in that mode of, ridding themselves and trying to evaluate the stock.
Yeah, I think a lot of companies over time run into that problem, lose that energy that you need to keep running ahead.
So you retired from Linkabit, as you said, or left MACOM for a few months, but then you teamed up very quickly with some colleagues to launch Qualcomm. What prompted you to start Qualcomm?
Well, when I left Linkabit, which was on April 1st, sending out an email saying I'm resigning on April Fool's Day, that was a very complicated email to write and to send out, but I left on April 1st. I was debating whether to go back to academia, which was attractive, whether to go into venture work, venture capital work, which was interesting. Being in a company, coming up with new products, we'd come up with some very exciting ones at Linkabit and grown the company 50, 60% every year profitably. And so that was exciting. And so I went off with the family to a trip in Europe. I had been talking before I left with six others that had worked with me at Linkabit that were saying, hey, we ought to try to do it again. I decided on the trip when I came back. And when I came back, okay, let's give it another try. I told my wife, Joan, that maybe we get to 100 people on this one. Don't expect the same kind of success we had with Linkabit. And off we went.
What do you know? It was bigger.
And again, with both companies, we didn't have a business plan to get started. We knew digital cellular in this case was going to be big, large, and exciting, but what role we would play wasn't quite clear. And in neither company did we go with venture capital. It was all family, friends, and then some private financing.
So Qualcomm pioneered the use of the CDMA technology for commercial cell phone networks for 3G. How was it developed? You know, how did you decide to develop that given that TDMA was widely used?
Right. Very shortly after we started Qualcomm, which was in July 1st of 85, ended up getting some consulting contracts. People knew us from Linkabit, so offered us some consulting. That was a way to get started. And one of them was with Hughes Aircraft up in Los Angeles, who had submitted a proposal to the FCC for a mobile satellite system, that is a satellite that could work with mobile vehicles. And they hired us to take a look at their proposal, see if there was anything wrong with the technical aspects, whether it might be something better. And it was on after the second visit up there, driving back from Los Angeles to San Diego, that I realized that with mobile communications, that, you know, you may have somebody speaking, the other person's quiet, then it's shifting, or both may be quiet while they're thinking, that how do you make use of that channel capacity? And that in a mobile system, you can't put them all together because they're all separate locations. So it's very hard to do. But it occurred to me that with CDMA, the limitation on capacity is how many are interfering with the signal at that at any given time. And so anytime you're quiet, you're not interfering. And so I had the thought, Klein Gilhausen was driving the car. I suggested, Klein, after we get back, let's take a look at the CDMA for this. A couple of days later, I stopped in a Klein's office and I said, Klein, how's it coming? And he looked at me and said, were you really serious about that? So I said, yeah, it's worth exploring. And he came up with a whole set of additional ideas on why CDMA might be useful. It has resistance interference. So rather than having to use different frequencies on adjacent beams, you could use the same frequency and just take use of decoding to keep things separated. And that would work in cellular as well. And a few other kind of very good ideas that came up. And of course, big problem was power control. How do we do power control? And CDMA came up with a three-level way of dealing with that, three different control loops to do that. And we said, well, this looks interesting. Hughes supported us to build a satellite simulator and a receiver to go test this, which we did on a mountaintop near us. And everything seemed fine, but then they decided to drop the program because it looked like it was going to be several years, and it was at least 3 years before the FCC would come back and award a consortium at that point ability, a license to go ahead with mobile communications. And so we were too small, didn't have the money to pursue CDMA, but we had a contract to develop a system for satellite communications with trucking, with the trucking industry. So a truck could be anywhere in the country, commands from its headquarters, send them back, and also get position location. And so we decided to follow up on that work. And we did that. And in September of 98, October of 98, we signed a contract with Schneider, which was the largest trucking company at the time, to supply these. And then I immediately diverted income from that. Let's go back and look at CDMA. Well, it took us a few months to work through where we left CDMA to get some confidence that, yeah, this was a reasonable way to go for cellular industry at the time. And during that period, the industry had been exploring CDMA, FDMA, TDMA, had in Europe, selected TDMA, GSM, form of TDMA. All the governments had signed an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, to only use TDMA, use GSM. So there's no flexibility there. The U.S. In January had a vote on whether to go TDMA or FDMA and selected TDMA. So the U.S. was on a path to go ahead January of 89 on. To go ahead with TDMA. And it wasn't until March or April that we did get an appointment with Pactel Cellular to describe CDMA to them. And the one edge we had, the one reason that anybody would even talk to us, was CDMA looked at, appeared to have the promise of going several times more subscribers on an antenna and a given amount of bandwidth than TDMA. TDMA was about three. We ultimately came and thought that CDMA would get 10 to 20, eventually to get back up to 50. But that it could provide a significant economic advantage. And so the carriers did kind of encourage us to go ahead and try this. And they set up a meeting in June in Chicago with a large number of people from the industry. And I went and gave a slideshow on CDMA. And I really had the feeling at that point that somebody was going to raise their hand and say, you forgot about this technical issue and that technical issue. This is why it's not going to work. And luckily, nobody did. At the end, somebody did raise their hand and said, why are you talking to the CTIA? Why aren't you talking to the standards group about this? And so off we went. And unfortunately, you know, putting slides out isn't enough to convince anybody. So nobody found a problem, but nobody believed us either, that we had solved key problems and that we'd have a capacity advantage. And so very quickly, we put together a demonstration system, two cell sites and a mobile phone that took a van to drive it around, and invited people back. I had to send out the invitations in September. There were those engineers that said, we're not going to be ready for several months, so hold off. But I knew that people were running ahead with TDMA. We couldn't wait too long. And so I did set up the date for early November. And we invited everybody in to come and visit, which a large group did. We made presentations. I was finishing the last presentation before sending out people to hear our phone and our capability, both in the van and in the lab, both ends of the call, when somebody from the back of the room, one of the engineers, waved to keep talking. I often say it's lucky I was a university professor, because you get used to talking 50 minutes fairly easily, as you can see. And so I kept talking, and luckily about 40 minutes later, I had a hand wave that it's okay to send everybody out. What had happened was we were using a GPS system to synchronize our two base stations. And at one of them, the receiver had failed, and it took a while to get it working again and get everything aligned again. And luckily we did before I had to send everybody home. That worked out very well. Convinced some of the operators that perhaps we ought to take a deeper look at CDMA, and got some support from them. By the way, they made us go and do the demo in Manhattan as well to make sure it would work with the big towers. And a story I often tell there is we had a group, we could only use the spectrum at night because it was so crowded. And so doing that night, we had a group of our engineers in a van with their computers and so on. And people would come up, peek in the window of the van, see all these people working around computers, thinking it was the police, and go running. So nobody ever bothered them. And of course, the system worked fine in New York as well. In any case, the other issue was we needed, therefore, to get chips. You had to be able to make a commercial-sized handset. You had to make a commercial-sized base station. And to do that, we needed to develop the CDMA chips. And to do that was an expensive proposition. So the question was, how do you pay for that? And one way was we did get some support from some of the carriers. And another kind of was innovative on the business side and thought of a licensing approach where we get an upfront payment for a license for CDMA. And should it ever turn out to be commercial, a small royalty for each device. And most people don't worry about the royalty because this was never going to go commercial anyway. But in any case, finally, after a long period, negotiated the first one with AT&T and then closed with a number of other manufacturers, a few Japanese, Motorola, others, Nokia. And that gave us the funding to develop the chips. And we had been developing chips, obviously, back at Linkabit. And we had developed actually a couple of chips for our OmniTrack, so one in particular at Qualcomm. And so we set off to develop five chips, actually, for the base station and the handset, three that we go on the handset. And 2 years later, we called everybody back again to demonstrate that we now had a commercial-sized handset and a commercial sizable base station. And the people there were impressed enough that they set up a contest, a meeting in December in Dallas for the teenage people to come in, for us to come in, and for anybody else that might have a competing technology to come in to see about a wideband standard. And so we, in preparation for that, took some very nice audios on both sides of our conversations. We did videos, you can see way we're driving, and video showing the soft handoffs between base stations. We had a very nice package put together for that. At that meeting, the first up were the TDMA folks, and they had only audio, and it was, in my regard, but I think most people's regard, terrible. It was staticky. It was not high quality voice audio. And then we came up and presented the videos and the audio, and they all sounded great. And that then, with a vote of CTIA, led to convince the TIA, the standards body, to go ahead with a wideband standard. The vote was to tell the TIA to do that. TIA set up a standards committee in April, and this was 92. We went ahead and set up, had a standards. We had done all kinds of experimental work with all these manufacturers who over the years were developing the chips, had all the reasons CDMA was going to fail. And as a result, we'd be able to, we worked on each one of those, found experiments, showed it continued to work. We had all that data available for the standards, finished the standard in a year and a half. And so by the midsummer 93, the TIA approved the standard, and we were all set to go and try to go commercial. This was still the second generation of technology. And a few of the carriers in the US were willing to go with us. But the first commercial operation was Hong Kong. And why Hong Kong? Because people at that time couldn't afford offices. A lot of them worked on the street. They worked with their cell phones. The spectrum was terribly overcrowded. And so the operator there was looking for more efficient use of spectrum and did sign up for with Motorola for the CDMA infrastructure. The only people manufacturing phones at that time was Qualcomm. And so we manufactured the phones from in San Diego to send to Hong Kong. We then convinced South Korea earlier that they should consider CDMA. And how did we do that? This was back in about 91. How do we do that? By talking with the government that and the industry that they were trying to get into commercial electronics, that they at that time were always a little behind the Japanese companies. And as a result, they could compete only on price. With CDMA, Japan already decided to go TDMA, a slight variant on what the US was doing, but very slight. And therefore, should CDMA work, they'd end up, in that case, ahead of Japan. At the time, there was very little cellular manufacture in South Korea. Neither Samsung nor anyone there really had any cellular manufacturing. It was all pretty much Motorola and European companies. And so this was a chance for them to get ahead. And of course, as we know, it did all work out. So operators in the beginning of 96 in South Korea were the next two operators to go CDMA, and then it came to the US. And then for the next few years, there was this, people referred to it as a religious war between TDMA and CDMA. The Europeans were committed to GSM, TDMA, and so they were spreading it around the world. We were trying to then compete, tried to get into China, tried to get in, eventually did, into India, eventually did, and other countries. But there were these battles going on, each one of which has its own story. We were then approaching third generation. Third generation was, how do you officially send data as well as voice? And everybody was now recognizing that probably at that point CDMA was the best way to go. So we had some standards issues back and forth with the Europeans, a battle. Ultimately, we made a strategic decision, although we've been making handsets and some of the infrastructure, to sell both of those operations, because we would like to have the manufacturing end up being worldwide with CDMA. If we were competing with other manufacturers and doing both the chips and the software, how would they ever trust us? So we sold the infrastructure to Ericsson and the handset division to Kyocera, and got out of both businesses in 99. And our stock at that point went up a factor of 26, and went crazy, but that was the internet boom period. In any case, we made the strategic decision to focus on the technology. How do we improve it, make it run ahead as fast as possible, and similarly, the software. And so we had started looking at data early on. Others had. So again, as we approached at that point, the third generation, everybody was saying CDMA. One of the aspects of selling the infrastructure to Ericsson was that we agreed there wouldn't be any patent issues between us, and that they would support third generation CDMA, or the wideband CDMA. And so that's how we moved into third generation.
So you mentioned how Qualcomm stock, you know, really skyrocketed. It's still doing very well. So you're very active in philanthropy, taking the Giving Pledge, and you've already donated a lot of money to universities, local community groups, and other institutions. So what drives you on that side of being so generous with your fortune?
Well, first of all, it would never have happened if I didn't end up with a good engineering education. Hadn't met my wife at Cornell. She was there because the state was subsidizing home economics at the time, so she had a, in a sense, a free ride tuition-wise. I had scholarships all the way through Cornell, as well as working continuously. And then at MIT, ended up with fellowship and then research assist. So I had a lot of support. So when we're in a position to do so, we felt we ought to be supporting others to be able to be in a similar position. So education has always been something very high on our giving list because we had benefited so much from that. And so we give out, we have scholarships and fellowships at MIT, obviously, Cornell, obviously, UCSD, obviously, the Technion. And we set up some at high school in the name of my high school teachers who had convinced me to go into engineering for students that are graduating New Bedford high schools. And so that was a motivation. And as things became more and more successful, and then I retired in 2005 as CEO and chair, well, initially CEO and a few years later as chairman, we became more active. We have three criteria for philanthropy we always look at. One is it an area we believe in? So education, clearly. Social services, very important. Cultural activities, which, by the way, we also supported corporate-wise. And I always argued that employees are the most important aspect of a company. And to attract and keep employees, it's important that the community be very good and that employees have these other opportunities, both education-wise, but also culturally. And so it's important for the shareholders that we also support these type of activities in the community. And so we had done that as a company, and then we started doing it certainly individually. And that continued when the Giving Pledge, they had, I think, the first meeting. It wasn't called the Giving Pledge at the time, but they were trying to think how to proceed ahead. There was a dinner in New York, and then we were invited to a small one up in San Francisco. Heard about it, said, yeah, we'd sign on whenever they kind of came up with something. And that's how we ended up being part of the Giving Pledge, one of the early signers.
That's wonderful. It, as you say, it takes a village to breed this kind of success. So our last question for you, as you look forward and see cellular technology evolving to 6G and who knows what comes after that, what is your vision? And perhaps we've outgrown the term cellular for what's going on.
Well, certainly wireless is a key phrase as opposed to cellular. And we're all going wireless. More and more capability is wireless. I was a little sad more recently that in naming Qualcomm, we included two M's. So it was communications, but in fact, we ended up in computing and a lot of software as time went on. So one M might have been more appropriate, but two M's looks like a wave, so that worked out. In any case, I think that wireless is going to be more and more important to all aspects of our life. We've seen with the pandemic how communications, Zoom and other services have worked so well. And many people access those on small wireless devices. Most internet access, I think, worldwide is probably on small handsets, small devices. And so that's going to continue to allow us to be connected. I think we've learned a little bit about education in this period. It was very controversial before. Very few people were willing to do communication and education over the net. But I think now we've gotten a little experience. There's still a lot of opposition, but I think we've learned a bit. And I suspect that going forward, that the use of both dream-based and in-person education, in fact, is going to continue to grow and reach people worldwide. I think that we're going to see wireless become more important with robotics, with drones. By the way, the helicopter on the Mars has a Qualcomm chip in it that was designed initially for drones, that includes photography, communications, control, et cetera. And the JPL people are able to adopt the software to make it run the helicopter properly. And so the wonderful thing is you develop capabilities that you have certain things in mind, and then people come up with lots of other ways of applying them. At Qualcomm, we early on set up what we call the Wireless Reach Program to see about additional social ways of using wireless technology. So how does it help fishermen? How does it help farmers, education, medical folks, et cetera? And I think all of those got off to very good starts and, again, are expanding very rapidly given the pandemic. So virtual education, I think, is here, and that will continue. Hybrid education will, I think, be a very important part. And I think it's important because although we haven't seen huge productivity gains because of robotics, because of artificial intelligence, which is moving into the chips and into the edge and into the device more and more, it's going to be happening. It takes business a while to adopt these things and get the improvements that show up as significant improvements in productivity. And so people are worried that it's going to reduce the number of hours needed to produce things, which I think is going to be happening, but we'll be able to produce them with fewer hours. And so I think we're looking toward moving sometime not too far in the future into a four-day week and maybe even shorter, which says, how do you spend your time? Well, part of that time, you're going to be wanting cultural activities that will be available virtually, streaming. You're going to want education. You're going to want to do different hobbies, games. All of those are going to be supported wirelessly. And so the future is still wide open. Whenever I talk to students, I'm always encouraging them that saying, yeah, lots already happened, but you've got a lot ahead of us, a lot to handle. And of course, one of our major crises right now has to do with the environment. And I think that wireless will have a role to play as far as having distributed sources of energy, of electricity, as far as controlling the networks that bring it from where natural resources might exist, wind, sun, at any given time elsewhere. I think that the wireless communication is going to play a major part there. So we have a lot of issues that we have to deal with going forward. I think that I remain optimistic. We will face up to them and do it. And I think technology will play a major role.
Well, thank you, Erwin, for taking the time to talk with us today, share your experience creating the wireless industry as we know it. It's truly an honor to speak with you, and we appreciate, I'm sure we speak for our listeners as well, for giving back so generously, supporting education, your community, and the arts. You truly are an RF industry icon. And for our listeners, please check out our other podcasts and future episodes of RF Industry Icons. You'll find them at podcasts.microwavejournal.com.